Right, so welcome to multimedia security. sorry for not putting up the steganography papers earlier, but here they are now, since today. there are four papers in Studon at the usual place in the subdirectory literature. So four papers. From the same group. So this is not the only group that has worked on steganography, but I find this combination of this particular combination of the papers very interesting. And I will explain this in a minute. But that is the reason why the same actors or authors reappear here in all these four papers. So what are these papers? So here's an abbreviation of the place or the journal where this paper was published. So IH is the Information Hiding Conference 2011. That was also at Information Hiding 2011. That was at Information Hiding 2010. And this is a, so these are three conference papers, and this is a journal paper from Transactions on Information Forensics and Security 2010. Okay, so when you submit a paper to a journal, it takes a while until it is reviewed. Then they say, oh, can you please change this, or I don't understand that, so it comes back to you. Change it again, send it back. It again takes an awful lot of time to review it and so on. So if you like knowing that Transactions on Information Forensics was published in 2010, it means that the work itself was done in 2008 or 2009. And then they send it there. Conferences are quicker. Because it's a binary decision. So you send something there, someone reads it, maybe even reads it very quickly, and then decides whether he or she likes it or doesn't, and then it's accepted or it's not. So that means, in terms of temporal ordering, this is the oldest work, then comes Information Hiding 10, and then comes Information Hiding 11. Yeah? Okay. And the so the nice thing about these papers is that they together sort of tell a story, like a pattern recognition, steganalysis, steganography story, which makes it actually so nice to look at them, apart from the sometimes complicated technical content, yeah. But let's abstract ourselves a little bit from that. And today I would like to sort of retell that story. And we can, I mean, at a fairly abstract level, and we can talk about additional details if you like in the exercises on Thursday. Or if really necessary next week, but I would like to start another topic next week, ideally. Okay, so what is that story? So let's start with the oldest paper, the Transactions on Information Forensics and Security 2010. So the title, okay, let's look at the authors first. So Tomáš, he was either a PhD student or a postdoc at that time. So he was relatively, like comparatively junior. Patrick and Jessica, they are in the business already for a long time and they are well known in the field. And they submitted this work, Steganalysis by Subtractive Pixel Adjacency Matrix. So stack analysis, it means our goal is to discover that a steganographic message has been embedded into an image. And and the claim is, this paper presents a method for detection of steganography. Is that readable at all? Or yeah, okay. This paper presents a method for detection of steganographic methods that embed in the spatial domain. So we had that duality, spatial domain, frequency domain. So this aims at spatial domain by adding a low amplitude independent stego signal, an example of which is LSB matching. So the least significant bit matching, that is also then loosely addressed in the exercises, is by design something that should be addressed by this method. So, and then first arguments are provided for modeling the differences between adjacent pixels using first order and second order Markov chains. Oh boy, what are Markov chains? I don't know. Did you attended pattern analysis? Okay. Okay. The good thing is it's not so important. I mean, it's one of these details that, turns out to be not so complicated, in terms like conceptually. Yeah. So subsets of sample transition probability matrices are then used as features for a stack analyzer implemented by support vector machines. Okay. So that's a rather technical description of what is going on. If you have a pattern recognition background, you certainly recognize the term support vector machines. That is a classifier. So you enter a description of something. In this case, we would like to describe a part of an image, and we associate a question like, does this contain a steganographic message, or is it like an original image? Yeah, that is the question. The classifier then says yes or no. So it has to be a yes or no question. Or you can also design it in a way that you get a distance. Yeah. So the question is then, to what degree do you believe that there's a steganographic message in there? And the classifier says 0.8. And then you have to do something with that, this degree of belief. Okay, so that's the support vector machine. And the description that is entered there, these are these first order, second order Markov chains in one way or another. Okay. So, in order to better understand the type of argument that is pulled there, let's have a look at that picture. Let me make this a little bit larger. Yeah, it's maybe too large. So here's a quantitative argument. On the x-axis and on the y-axis, we have two adjacent pixels from a number of pictures, from 10,000 pictures. And the brightness here indicates the probability, like the joint probability if pixel IJ has intensity 50, then it's most likely that the neighboring pixel also has intensity 50. That is what it says. So it says, almost all neighboring pixels are identical. Yeah. And that is, something that we already, like an argument that we already pulled in the exercises to look at the least significant bit embeddings. Actually, it's a very common argument. It's also like when you do weather prediction, it's actually safest to just say like the weather for tomorrow, it's going to be like it was today. because actually these transitions are comparably rare. Here's a second picture that looks at the exactly same thing, just from a slightly different perspective. So here on the x-axis, we have the difference of two neighboring pixels in the range of, well, let's say -8 to +8. But the interesting part is even more in the center. For absolute pixel intensities of 64, 128, and 196. And we see, okay, the 196 is a little bit steeper. So they just went through the pictures and grabbed these pixel intensities and then looked at the neighbor and formed the difference. So the 196 distribution is a little bit steeper. But in general, like these distributions look quite similar. Yeah. Okay. And considerations of this type lead them to the idea to look at local differences of pixels. Yeah. And these are and this is what is expressed by these first and second order Markov chains. Yeah. So let's have a look at the title again quickly. That is what will be the subtractive pixel adjacency matrix. Yeah. Okay. Good. So the overall idea of this work is to say, let me write this down quickly. remarks on Pevney and others. Tiffs. 2010. The overall idea is look at the differences of neighboring pixels with the goal of learning a rich. So rich means like large, yeah? Like a large, let's say large statistical model of what local neighbors typically look like. For example, we can look, so yeah, what means rich? We can say we look at the differences of two neighboring pixels. That was this motivating example at the beginning, yeah? But then if we wonder, like, can we make our model larger, then the answer is, yeah, of course, yeah? I mean, why just look at two neighboring pixels? We could also look at all combinations of three neighboring pixels, for example, yeah? And these are already quite a bit because we can go in horizontal direction, in vertical direction, we can look at, so we get quite some combinations, and then also in terms of intensity content, yeah? I mean, for two neighboring pixels, we see, okay, the intensities differ in curves that look like this, depending on the intensity offset. Yeah, but when we look at combinations of three pixels, then we obtain, per combination, we obtain a three-dimensional histogram of these differences. So that already makes the model larger. Yeah, and that is what is meant by large, because of course we would like to look at all of those, or as many as possible of those differences at the same time, yeah, in order to characterize a natural image. Yeah. So typically means in a natural image, yeah. Natural and non-stego image, yeah. Right, so the specific approach is look at, so first of all, do we have to do a high pass filtering or not? I think we should, but I did not highlight the position where they write it. Okay, doesn't matter. We can add this later, yeah? So the specific approach is to model the second order joint probability. Of two neighboring pixels, so we have MUV is the probability of observing DIJ plus one equals U given DIJ equals V with U V element of some range of values from minus T plus T, and outside of this value range these values are cropped. Yeah, so that is so we see the most interesting, when we look at the plot in the background, yeah, the most interesting differences are here, these little differences, yeah. So we sort of cut off this histogram at some threshold plus minus t, yeah. But within that histogram, we say, okay, so if so, let's look at two neighboring differences and we just form a statistic. How often does it happen that the right pixel or the right difference has a value of U, the left difference a value of V? Yeah, that is what it says essentially. Yeah, so the how often did we observe that the right difference was u, and the left difference was v. Okay, and we can also do the same thing for third order relationships and just between three neighboring pixels, yeah? And then we just form M U V W. Sorry, I didn't understand the point, didn't explain the pointer yet. Okay, and that is just the joint probability of having dij plus 2 equals u, given dij plus 1 equals v, and dij equals w. Yeah? So we form a three-dimensional histogram, essentially. So the question here is essentially the same question as above, just that we have three neighboring differences involved instead of two. And then we have two more remarks. These differences can be formed in horizontal direction, vertical direction, vertical and diagonal direction. So that makes a lot of histograms with a lot of potential entries depending on the value range minus t plus t. So that's a large model, or what they meant with large models. Yeah, but okay, I mean, you can train it from 100,000 images or something. It doesn't cost you much, no? You just let it run through and build up these histograms. Yeah. And what we can do in order to make the model a little bit smaller again is we put a symmetric combinations in the same bin, yeah? And we treat horizontal and vertical identically. So let me illustrate this in a minute. So let's say we look at these third order differences, yeah, in horizontal direction, and we observe a pattern that says, so 3, 2, 2, yeah, in one pixel. And in another pixel, also in horizontal direction, we make an observation 2, 2, 3. And we say, okay, so this is a symmetric result or a symmetric outcome. So we put them in one bin. Yeah. So we count, when we see this, we look for a rotational, like for a combination that we already have on our list, and we add just one here. Yeah. Okay. The same thing if we would then observe in vertical direction 3, 2, 2. We would also say, okay, we count it to the spin. Yeah, okay. Not 100% sure about diagonal right now, but yeah, okay, you got the idea. Okay, and this histogram then forms the feature vector that is presented to a support vector machine and that has to decide, is it a manipulated image or not? Yeah. And this was a successful method. I think it's also on that list that I've shown to you by the Signal Processing Society. I closed it already. Okay. Not so important. This was a successful method. Just trying to see if there's anything else that I wanted to say specifically to that paper. Probably not. So how about just moving on to the second one? Unless there are, sorry, yeah.
I have a question to the probability that is written on the.
Yeah, let me make it dark.
The thing is, I calculate my probability.
Yeah.
Based on what? Do I take the image, only one single image, and I hope that this image is not corrupted in such a way that I cannot detect it, or is it? I take 10,000 images and make my probability basis on 10,000 random images.
So you take images in order to train that model, yeah? You take images from a certain source that you know, like where you know, okay, these images come directly from a camera, for example.
Yeah? I need a training set.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Ah, okay. Yes. And then.
That wasn't really clear, so I was not sure.
Yeah, it's a classification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. You use your training images to build up histograms that contain these joint two neighbor differences and these joint three neighbor differences. Yeah. And then you say, okay, so this is not a stego image. Yeah. To your classifier. This is also not a stego image. This is also not a stego image. And then you make some steganographic embeddings into your images. Yeah. With methods that you implemented yourself. Yeah. Like the least significant bit embedding and so on. And then you tell the classifier, look, like this is a stego image. This is also a stego image. And it is the task of the classifier to figure out which differences between those histograms are actually significant or indicative of a steganographic embedding. Yeah. And
it means that I can train my classifier only with those steganography methods I understand myself or I have knowledge of.
Yes. Okay, you are, what you bring up is the problem of generalization. Yeah. So, and that's actually an important thing. Yeah. So the question, like, to what do we generalize with this approach? And which points are, like, which are sensitive points? Yeah. So one thing certainly is I can only train my classifier with steganographic embeddings that I know. So I must make a certain assumption. So it's a least significant bit type embedding, or it's a, like these, as they say in the abstract, it's a spatial embedding. And I can play with the parameters when I create my training set to show to the classifier example embeddings, but certainly the classifier will not be able to see embeddings exactly of that kind as what he has to decide later. But actually, so that is one thing, yeah? But we could maybe say, okay, we can deal with that problem, but there's a second problem also. And that is that when you present the original images to the classifier, what the classifier actually learns is, or at least to some extent, what it learns is the camera model. Yeah? And why is that? Because when you think of the camera processing pipeline, so what happens in the camera? And actually, it's a powerful property of these features, yeah, that they also cover the camera. But actually, it may be a problem for steganographic detection if you can only train on cameras that are very different from the cameras, like from the pictures, camera pictures that you want to do your steg analysis on. So what happens in a digital camera? So we have the lens. So this is our camera model, yeah? So we have the lens. Light falls. This is maybe the worst lens picture ever. Anyways, so points that come from one point in the scene are bent by the lens onto the same position at the sensor. So that is the purpose of a lens. There might be slight unsharpness issues due to chromatic aberration or so, yeah? So we have some chromatic aberration and so on. And what is the other? There are some types of aberration. So here's the sensor. The sensor has a certain readout noise and other properties. Yeah, we might introduce correlations here if we have a line readout or so. Yeah, okay. And then we have some, so we have the digital signal processor below that. Oh, hold on, I forgot something. It's okay, we pack it in here. Where we do a debayering. So the sensor, typically it's not a full color sensor that you have red, green, and blue at each pixel, but instead you have a color filter that on one pixel is sensitive to red, on another pixel sensitive to blue, on a third pixel red, green, blue, and green again, because the human eye is more sensitive to green. And then the debayering essentially interpolates locally all three colors to each pixel. Yeah, so we have a small interpolation here. And then maybe we do some sharpening or some other improvements, whatever, and then we have a gamma adjustment. It's a nonlinear filtering of the image such that the picture looks more vivid. And then we do our JPEG encoding over 8x8 blocks. Yeah. Okay, now roughly speaking, that is what is going on from photons coming to the camera to picture coming out of the camera. And so there are a lot of local operations going on, yeah? Like operations that affect a local neighborhood of just a couple of pixels. And they are specific to the way how this camera is built, how the digital signal processor is programmed, and so on and so on. Yeah. So the artifacts of these, because none of these steps is perfect, so all of them really leave some artifacts in the final picture. All these artifacts are also modeled by these histograms. Yeah, and that means it's like if you're performing stack analysis, it's really desirable if you can get like an angle on what camera has been used, yeah? Maybe the vendor at least or something, no? To get a little bit closer with your trained model to the actual data. And that is actually where the fourth paper excels. So I told you it's three papers and another one. so that is what the fourth paper is good for. The fourth paper is breaking Hugo, the process discovery. Because there they describe how they attacked a steganographic system. And they were trying to figure out what camera has been used for acquiring that benchmark data set. It's really nice. So let's make a note here. The camera, so the image formation in the camera contains several local operations. So local means within 2, 3, 4, 5 pixels, yeah? We inadvertently model the statistical artifacts of image formation or of the camera in our I did not introduce this in our spam features. Why spam features? So that is the title of the paper, the subtractive pixel adjacency matrix. That is the name of these like that the group gave to this feature set. No? First page here. The subtractive pixel adjacency matrix spam. Yeah, okay. Good. Now let's so we have to get a good model for the camera. Now let's have a look at the second paper. The second paper is the one in which they actually introduced the steganographic system that has been used for the challenge, on which then later this process discovery paper comes. So here. So that was information hiding 2010. Yeah, and the title is using high-dimensional image models to perform highly undetectable steganography. The authors, so Jessica is not part of this, yeah, but other than that, we know Tomáš already, we know Patrick already, and now here's a new, oh, here's another Tomáš Pevný. Pevný was the one who was also in the previous paper, and Tomáš Filler is now new here. So he was with Jessica at that time, but apparently Jessica was not on board here. Okay, so the whole idea here is to say, like, so they propose a complete methodology for designing practical and highly undetectable stego systems for real digital media. Okay, so the main design principle is to minimize a suitably defined distortion by means of efficient coding algorithm. The distortion is defined as a weighted difference of extended state-of-the-art feature vectors, so they mean their own, already used in stack analysis. This allows us to preserve the model used by stack analyst and thus be undetectable even for large payloads. Okay, so what does this mean in simple English? It means it essentially means the scheme that we just looked at, yeah, the spam features, they look at statistical weirdnesses in local pixel neighborhoods. Yeah, so I look at some differences, a couple of differences neighbored to each other, and I train from thousands of images what occurrences are expected or what co-occurrences are expected and which aren't. Yeah, and this actually, but this is a high-dimensional model. A classifier has to be trained with that model such that it can be, that these changes can be detected. Now, if I flip side and I think about doing steganography, can I make the embedding in a way such that a model for detecting this embedding would be just too large to be trained? Yeah. So, so that's maybe kind of a complicated concept if you have not been exposed to pattern recognition, but let me try to explain it anyways. So, hold on, where can we? All right. So the idea is this. Let's look at this section really quickly. It's a very short section. I think we can read it right away. So we just heard about stack analysis. They are essentially restating what was written in the previous paper. And then they say from stack analysis to steganography. So almost all state-of-the-art statistical stack analyzers, with the exception of stack analyzers for least significant bit replacement, are based on a combination of stack analytic features and pattern recognition algorithms. So it essentially means we define a feature like these histograms of the co-occurrences, and we train a classifier like a support vector machine to tell, is there something in there or not? In stack analysis, stack analytic features are used to reduce the dimension of a space of all cover objects so that the pattern recognition algorithms can learn, if possible, the difference between cover and stego objects in a reduced feature space. Using such a low dimensional model for designing steganography usually leads to overtraining to a particular feature set. The issue of feature set completeness is discussed in, okay. Keeping this in mind, we believe that the features can serve as a good precursor of the image model to determine the embedding cost rho I. So they mean, okay, if I look at the type of features that a stack analyzer uses and how stable these features are, I can associate a cost for an embedding, and I can say it's much more risky, so it's more expensive to embed into specific areas where the features are very strong. We will see this translates to where a detector has a lot of statistics. So that means if I have a statistical detector, it will certainly find a distortion there. And conversely, I can recommend to embed in areas where a stack analytic detector has very poor statistics, you know? Because then he has to say anyways, so I don't know, yeah? It could be like this, could be like that. Okay. Although we show this transition from stack analytic features to steganographic model on spatial domain steganography, we believe that the ideas and tools presented here can be used in other domains and with other stack analytic features as well. Okay. We start by reviewing the recently proposed span features. Then we discuss the problem of overfitting the steganographic model to stack analytic features, as well as the remedy by expanding the model beyond the capabilities of contemporary pattern recognition algorithms. Finally, we propose a simple method to identify parts of the model that are more important for stack analysis. Yeah, so the idea is to say, okay, if I use a feature capacity that that can just decide whether it would be easy or hard for a classifier to determine whether there's an embedding in that region, yeah, I can look at larger co-occurrences. So that is a simpler task than making the actual decision. So this means I can look at larger neighborhoods, and a classifier, in order to detect this, would need to look at an even larger neighborhood, like a neighborhood that is a little bit larger than what I have looked at, in order to be smarter than me. Yeah. And this would be a model that would be so large that we would not be able to train this, or no one knows how to train this. Yeah. Okay. Another remark, this was in the pre-deep learning era. Would be interesting to follow up. I didn't do this now, but to what extent statements changed, boundaries changed, than with the advent of pre-deep learning. Yeah. So I did not check that. But I think in general, the argument is maybe intuitively clear. Yeah. So I can say if my detector sees a neighborhood of 3 pixels, but I can look at a neighborhood of 3 to 4 pixels just to determine how difficult it would be for a detector to look at these pixels, then a detector would even need to be trained on, let's say, a neighborhood of 5 pixels or so to be able to outsmart me on this, yeah? And to say like, oh, that's an even larger neighborhood that you did not consider. Now, why is it a problem to look at larger and larger neighborhoods? That is something that is like an intrinsic property in pattern analysis. There's something, or pattern recognition, that's called the curse of dimensionality, yeah? So, hold on, these are remarks on Pevney and others, information hiding. The curse of dimensionality is a concept in machine learning. That states that the difficulty, I mean, the original formulation is a little bit different, but let me get straight to the point here, to our application. So the difficulty of classifying a feature vector grows over proportionally I mean typically it's something it's like exponential or at least almost exponential with the dimensions of the feature vector. So it means if my feature vector has, if I just keep increasing the number of feature dimensions, and then it turns out I have to train more and more sophisticated classifiers with more and more data, and that growth is not linear. So it means if someone is forcing me to go into higher dimensional spaces, sooner or later I run into trouble to be able to train my model at all. Yeah. And the whole point of this deep learning hype is that it sort of pushed the boundary a little bit higher such that we can train more complex models. Yeah. That's all. That is why everyone is talking about it. So that means this is a real, like it's a real problem. It's not just some theoretical idea. Yeah? Okay.
The assumption for this hypertrophy was that Ellis and Ball, supervised by the one, and Wendy has a lot of time installed for the images they exchange.
Yeah.
And they are supervised the next 20, 30 years.
Yeah, that is certainly a criticism that, yeah, I mean, of course, it's, like if you I mean that's certainly a criticism that could be brought here fairly easily, no? I think still, I'm not sure that it's fair. So, because what we saw with the deep learning stuff was that it really made a step. No? So it was like a sudden nonlinear step in the capacity. And the years before, I mean, there was always growth, no? I mean, with hardware capabilities, no? But it was like an unusual step when the deep learning stuff came, yeah? And that is also why I think it would be interesting to catch up with what the Stego people had been doing now in the presence of deep learning. No? How do they adapt to that? Yeah, I think you just have to define in your problem, okay, like what guarantees do you want to give? Like, should it hold for 2 years? Should it hold for 5 years? If it should hold for 30 years, yeah, that's then it becomes complicated. No? Yeah. So in that sense, it's right. And I think that's an interesting discussion because it exactly shows the dilemma also in which the embedder is, the steganographic embedder. Yeah. So the goal is to have an embedding that is undistinguishable from a statistically undistinguishable from a cover object, the background. Yeah. But the computational problem is to define this undistinguishability. No? So that is also a question that is somehow connected to computational resources. No? And you have to see what is practically feasible and what not, I guess. Yeah. So, I think you're absolutely right. No? It's... The long-term guarantees are not so great here. but nevertheless, I mean, this was a big, big thing, this steganographic challenge. So let me write two or three more remarks to this paper just to make sure that we get the message across. So, So what the claim on the computational feasibility, I mean exactly what you have been feasibility is here somewhere on page 5 or 6 or so. Here we propose to resolve the issue. So what they discussed before. So that is of overfitting of a detector to a specific to resolve the issue of overfitting to a particular model by expanding it beyond practical limits of stack analysis. That is exactly this argument. So if you can't train a classifier for it, then we should be safe, right? For this model. Okay. It's maybe not the best sentence to pick out because it requires a little bit context of the surroundings, but Nevertheless, I mean, that is this claim from the discussion that we had. Okay. So then the idea is, the idea actually is intuitively relatively straightforward. So assign a score or a score or a cost idea, assign a cost to each pixel neighborhood for a steganographic embedding. High cost is bad, yeah? High cost bad, don't embed, yeah? Corresponds to areas where we have very rich statistics, yeah? Areas with lots of examples or similar examples so this means we have a tight statistical model and therefore embedding there is super risky because it's easier for the classifier to figure out that this neighborhood looks unnatural, yeah? Classifier has easier task of finding anomalies. You can just imagine this in terms of the standard deviation or something, yeah? If you have a particular neighborhood that you've seen millions of times already, no? In natural images, but never like that in other images, yeah? Then you are so confident, no? I mean, your standard deviation here is virtually zero, no? And then you would say, oh, okay, so that is something that never occurs in a real image. So we would say, okay, so that is not a good area to embed something here, yeah? And low cost means embed here. And what are these low-cost areas? These are rare observations. If we think of the figure from the SPAN paper that we looked at first, yeah, these rare observations are, for example, edges. Yeah? Edge areas are relatively rare because most neighbored pixels are not edges. Rare observations like edges. Here it is more complicated. To distinguish cover images from Stego images. Okay. And there are some technical details attached, of course. If you attended pattern recognition, pattern analysis, some will look familiar. It's nice. It's a nice application of pattern recognition stuff in order to make the details happen. Yeah, to say, okay, how can I assign this cost when I compare a cover image to a Stego image? So I count the number of occurrences in the cover image and the Stego image, and see, okay, how and compare the probabilities. Okay, how much time do we have left? Oh, very little. Still, let's use those 10 minutes and let's have a look at the third paper, because then we are essentially through. So it's information hiding 2011. And so the story in between was there was this BOSS challenge, Break Our Stego System. Challenge was published in 2010, I think, that contained this highly undetectable embedding. Yeah. So they made this play on words that it was called Hugo. Hugo was the steganographic embedding. And then they called it Hugo Boss, like the okay. and then Jessica, together with a couple of other people from Binghamton, they came up with a way to detect. To detect those embeddings, and they actually won this challenge by quite some margin. And they wrote two papers on it. So one paper is this, and it contains the technical details, and I just show you the idea. And the second paper is the one where I said, okay, so this is the additional one, where they essentially just describe the things that they tried and the rationale or so when they were trying to break that Stego system. And I think it's very instructive. It also contains this part where they are trying to figure out what cameras the guys used in order to make the challenge, because they had this generalization problem with their stack analysis system to train the classifier. But here's the technical part. So they had a technical improvement, which sort of, because you said, okay, so what shouldn't it hold even for 20 years or so? Then it turned out it didn't even hold for 1 year, because they found a way to exploit the information that was there more efficiently, such that they could actually train models over a larger neighborhood, and therefore then discover these embeddings. So let me wipe this, or maybe I should not wipe this, because we need this. Which argument do we need? We need this, so I wipe this, okay. So here are remarks on Friedrich and others' stack analysis of content adaptive steganography. In spatial domain. Let's see what the abstract says. Content adaptive steganography constrains its embedding changes to those parts of covers that are difficult to model. Yeah, okay, we've seen that. Such as textured or noisy regions. When combined with advanced coding techniques, oh yeah, that is a detail, sorry, that I omitted, nevertheless, adaptive steganographic methods can embed rather large payloads with low statistical detectability, at least when measured using feature-based stack analyzers trained on a given cover source. The recently proposed steganographic algorithm Hugo is an example of this approach. The goal of this paper is to subject this newly proposed algorithm to analysis, identify features capable of detecting payload embedded using such schemes, and obtain a better picture regarding the benefit of adaptive steganography with public selection channels. This work describes the technical details of our attack on Hugo as part of the BOSS challenge. Okay, good. So, so there are a lot of details involved, and you saw I omitted the adaptive coding thing. So this detector, it's they call it Holmes, like the detective. Let me try to jump right to a key idea here. Yeah. So we said we need, or we, I just stated that claim. So we need a more, we need to look at a larger neighborhood. But the problem is that the feature dimensionality gets out of hand. There are just too many possibilities to look at combinations of like large spatially widely distributed pixels. So here's an example in this table. Yeah, horizontal residuals, they call it residuals now. These are essentially these neighborhood differences from higher order local models and their span S. And then, for example, when we look at sixth order residual vectors, we have seven neighbored entries to look at and their respective combinations. Yeah, so we have a histogram that becomes huge, no? If we like to fully train that. Okay, and what this work contains actually are strategies to get around this order of magnitude. And here's an idea I think that is intuitively makes immediately sense without looking too much into the technical details. So we concluded from the last work, or we said for the last work, edge areas are perfect for embeddings because we have such a large change there, and we only rarely observe such changes. So a classifier will have difficulties to get good training data in edge regions. Yeah? And the idea here is to say like, yeah, okay, if I look at an edge perpendicular to the edge area, it's indeed complicated, yeah? But it's only an edge in that direction, yeah? If I look at the pixels along this direction, then it's just, it's an almost flat area, yeah? And I can probably find a lot of similar examples in the data set, no? And train a decent classifier along that direction. Yeah? And that might allow then actually to detect embeddings that are in such complicated areas. Yeah? So, and this is the whole point, how they get essentially in these larger neighborhoods. Yeah, so they say, okay, let's look at these neighborhoods along one specific dimension, for example, and try to filter out these embeddings. Yeah? And here's a practical way, for example, to look at, like to decide in which region to look. Yeah. So they say, yeah, in principle, when I'm looking at the neighborhood relationship of pixels, I can look at their sums, I can look at their differences, like there are millions of ways. Yeah. So one approach that one particular case that turned out to be quite effective for attacking Hugo are the so-called min-max residuals, where they just take a number of residuals and look at the minimum or the maximum values of these residuals. And that means, for example, for pixel ij close to an edge, one of the min-max residuals will be large in the direction perpendicular to the edge, while the other will likely be computed along the edge. Features built from these min-max residuals thus better adapt to textures and improve detection of adaptive embeddings. So these are relatively simple operators that provide an important additional hint to the classifier, like, okay, look, this is a special area, no? Maybe there's an horizontal edge or there's a vertical edge, so you should look in the other direction, things like that. And then what they end up doing is that they compute not one single huge, super huge classifier, but instead a so-called ensemble classifier. And I'm not really sure whether we addressed this in any of our lectures, or at least seriously addressed this, but it means like we train a number of smaller classifiers just on a part of the feature space, and then in this case perform a voting scheme to put their individual opinions together. And that is a common strategy to increase the strength. So if each of those classifiers has an accuracy of 55%, but the information on which they are operating is not identical, so they are not, the information is not too much correlated. And then if we average those classifiers, detection accuracy indeed improves. Yeah. So that is the overall strategy of that approach, and that helped them to win the challenge. Okay, sorry, I'm over time. I will do a slightly extended recap on that next time, because that was fairly quick now towards the end. If you have the time, please have a look at the papers. Yeah, you don't need to go through all the technical details as usual, no? But in order to get the idea, I think it's a very nice development that can be followed here that happened within 2 or 3 years. And there's this nice bonus paper where they actually write how they came up with their solution. So the last paper of those three papers. Okay, thank you.